Today is the 14th of May 2012. My name is Therese Sweeney. This is the Pioneers of the Fringe Oral History Project, and I'm at Bateau Bay at my father's house, and I'm about to interview Michael Sweeney. What's your full name?
My full name is Hugh Robert Sweeney. My date of birth is 13136.
Where were you born?
I was born in a public hospital at Scone on the 16th of January 1936.
And what's your mother's full name and your father's full name?
My father's full name is Robert Hugh Sweeney. I don't know my mother's.
Linda, is it?
Yeah, Linda. No, that was her maiden name, Linda Hartman.
So it would be Linda Sweeney.
Yeah, Linda. Linda. Anyway, I'll leave it at Linda Sweeney. I'm not too sure about the actual thing.
So, where did you grow up?
Well, I've just found out now that I remained in Scone under the care of the hospital staff for 6 months. Then I was taken to the Waitara Children's Home, conducted by the Sisters of Mercy at Waitara, and I stayed there till I was about three, I think. Then I went to an orphanage, again run by the Sisters of Mercy, called Monte Pio at Maitland. Then when I was about five or six, I then went to an orphanage called Murray Dwyer at Maitland, East Maitland. East Maitland, yes. That was during the war, because I have avid memories of all the building windows blackened, and the American soldiers were over. They took over the Maitland Showground, which how the crow flies would have only been about 10 miles. I then left Murray Dwyer and went to St. Vincent's Boys Home, Westmead, when I was about 12. And I stayed there till 1954, where the brothers or St. Vincent de Paul's found me a boarding house at 24 Mount Street, Coogee, where I lived in a boarding house front room with a lovely lady called Mrs. Hodges.
All right, I'll just stop. Can I stop you there?
Yep.
So what were the circumstances around you? Why were you an orphan? Like, why were you put in an orphanage?
Well, what I know of, after my birth, apparently my mother had a bleeding problem, and I can't tell you any more about that other than the fact that she ended up in a home. I think at that time it was called a mental home. That was in a place in Westmead owned by the health department. And she stayed there till such times as I found her many, many years later.
So she was at Westmead and you were at Westmead?
Yeah, only a distance away, about 4 km, 5 km. Just next door to the old Westmead Speedway. And unbeknownst to me, I could have walked down there and saw her every day of the week if I wanted to. But I didn't know, see?
Was it postnatal depression?
That's what it would have been, I think, yeah. She kept on rocking the chair all the time, saying the rosaries, and they thought she was mad. She had more brains than any of them put together, I think. Yeah.
So, Dad, do you have any memories of your orphanage years that you want to talk about? Like, what was it like as a young child? Like, how did you feel?
I don't know anything about Monty Pio. I haven't got any recollection of that at all. But at Murray Dwyer was run by the Sisters of Charities. We used to call them the Butterfly Nuns. And there were about eight there. And Murray Dwyer was a pretty huge acreage place where all self-sufficient there. They had a farmer there, a permanent farmer, who supplied all the food we needed, eggs and et cetera. And I recall we had a draft horse called Wally. And Wally was used to come up to the out of the buildings from the farm every day and get to know the children. But he took a liking to me because I was probably the taller one than any of them. But I can't remember any names of those children that were there, and there was over 100. And the only thing other than that was interesting things. I remember sitting in the classrooms, and the nuns would drive the catechism into you all day and all day, you know. And I think I paid attention because I must have, I think I got a couple of straps across the back, the hands, because I stole one of the sisters' ball lollies on her desk when she went out of the room. Now, as far as exercise there, I only recall that we played soccer. There was no football or anything in those days. And one particular day, I got kicked in the private with a soccer ball, and I laid on the ground in agony. And the nun who was organising it didn't know what to do. So she had to run down and get the farmer. He didn't know much either. Anyway, I must have recovered that all right. There wasn't any room around the building for any other sports, but we were about, I'd say, a good quarter mile from the post office, and we had a track. And I used to ride the old draft horse, go and pick the mail up for the nuns. But nobody else would get on the horse because the horse must have liked me because, you know, and we'd bring it back. Now, I don't know how many times a week we did that, but I wouldn't have a clue. One of the amazing things about Murray Dwyer, there were a number of nuns who died there while I was there, and the nuns had a ritual. When the sister was dying, they had four of us kneel down the bed around the deceased nun, or going the dying nun, and say the rosary. I remember that very vaguely, and I know I did that a few times while I was there. They treated us, I can't remember how they treated us, but you can imagine the situation. The war was on. Nobody had any money. I can remember there's no such thing as salt, butter, or anything like that. We produced our own milk and all that sort of thing, which was a great benefit to the upkeep of the home. And other than that, I don't think I had any complaints about the place. And that
were
was
you, were you hungry? Do you remember being hungry?
No, I don't. Well, I can remember at 11 o'clock, they used to ring a bell and we'd be up in a sort of a quad triangle like they had at the valley. And they'd ring the bell and we'd go and have hot bread and dripping. Eh? Used to give us a slice of that before we went back in the classrooms again. I remember that pretty well. I don't even remember where the kitchen was or any part of the buildings, only that the fact that we must have had a chapel, but I don't remember that either because I was only a little kid. But I think I was pretty well behaved there. You had no choice anyway. You couldn't go anywhere because you're miles away from everything.
What about Westmead? What do you remember?
Now Westmead is a different kettle of fish. I got there about, I think I would have been 11 or maybe 12, as my baptismal dates were mixed up at that time. you can imagine the scariness of that, because Westmead was the drop-off for all the single mothers with children, you know. And they called them orphans, and some of them had a lot of money, some of the mothers, you know, or fathers. And there were 228 kids there when I first went there. So you imagine, with nine brothers and a couple of lay helpers, I don't know if they were paid or not, but I think they were. Like, we had a huge refectory, that's how we used to call it, instead of a meal room, the refectories. We had two dormitories consisting of two wings for the wet the beds, and a huge, what you see in
Oliver Twist days,
you know, beds on both sides, and the brother would have a room in the middle of it, and he'd walk up and down till 9 o'clock at night, lights are out, you play it up, you got a belt. You didn't get a belt, and we probably told her to, you know, shut up and get to sleep. They somehow gave me the job once again. They wet the beds. The kids were, you know, with problems, you know, scared of, you know. I don't really blame them, you know, but we're all individuals, so you wouldn't know what background the kids came from. And we'd have about 50 to 100 in each dormitory. They had their pajamas and sheets taken off them. My job was to sort of put them in the shower room, get dressed for class and everything, for breakfast. And then after that was over, we take all the wet stuff down to the laundry. Unfortunately, they had a beautiful big laundry steam thing where they could do the sheets and the pajamas in the space of about an hour. And I can't recall who made the beds, but that was every day of the week. They were wet, the beds. You can imagine the trauma that, you know, with the cost of the place. And each brother who was a teacher had a room where they sort of supervised if someone was very sick or something. Other than that...
What about sports? Did you play sports
there? Oh, yeah, sport was a big thing in Westmead.
And how were you placed there? Were you good at sport?
Yeah, I was. We started at Westmead, had four ovals, and none of us had very much sporting gear. And the football was all by weight divisions then, from 5'6" to 6 stones, 6'6", 7 stone, up to about 9 stone. And I can remember we never got beaten in a football game in our lives here, and had all these public school kids come in. And we had hardly any shoes on. We used to belt the Christ out of them.
So what position were you?
I played second row and fullback. I was probably average. Then we played cricket. I was a bit better at that because I was wicketkeeper and opening bat. And that was about all we could afford, I think. They eventually got a swimming pool, but the swimming pool was we had left by then anyway. And that was it. But there was a lot of fights. If you didn't like anyone, you used to go down. The brothers used to encourage you to go down to football three and fight it out. Yeah. And you'd get hurt sometimes and you win. And that's how it was.
Okay, so when you left there, how were you academically? Do you recall?
I didn't have any academical at all, because I can remember sitting in fifth and sixth class. And you can imagine the brothers have got 50-odd kids in each classroom. You know, you'd be lucky to even get a question. That's why half them played up there, because they had nothing to do. Then we went into first year, first form then, I think it was. But for some unknown reason, I used to be called out about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and go down and work in the kitchen until 7 at night, you know. Peeling potatoes and things like that, and learning the kitchen routine. And they had two women who used to come in and organise the food and that. But they got machines to peel potatoes, and they got machines to do this and that. But it was bloody hard work. Then I also was in charge of a boiler room. which was adjacent to the kitchen, and we had to make sure that the coal was stacked in there to keep the fires going, you know, for the heat. It was very demanding.
Why did you get chosen, do you think?
I don't know. That's a good question. Brother Combe, I don't know who. I think I was pretty responsible because you had to be responsible for the machinery. You had to learn all that. You just couldn't go in there and throw a potato in a machine unless you know what you've got to do with it. And that was three times a day, three meals. So you imagine the work involved. And they had a big washing up machine, and each two tables after every meal had to go and wash up, clean up the kitchen, rubbish and everything, and reset the tables before they went to school. And that was done periodically every day. It was routine, you know. If you didn't do it, well, you'd soon do it because the brother made sure you did it. The food wasn't interesting. You can understand there was no food around after the war because Westmead were very gifted. We had a huge farm which grew. We had our own dairies, milk, eggs. We grew our own vegetable patch. The only thing we had to buy was meat. And a bloke called Jack Hodges, I think his name was, he used to come and supply the meat for us. That's 220 plus 10 brothers. Imagine what donation he did. He did that for 50 years.
What, he donated food?
Donated meat for 50 years. Great old man. And that's about all. And we never starved or anything. There's no such thing as fruit or anything like that. You made sure you ate your porridge in the morning. Bear toast, because you couldn't put anything on, only jam, I think. And the old teapot, you know. If you didn't eat it or drink it then, well, they just take it off the table. So that's about the food section of it. Education-wise, as you said, I was always brought out in the first intermediate, was finished there. But I'd only do an hour or two in each classroom and I'd be downstairs all the bloody time, which I sort of, when I left Westmead, I educated myself. I don't know what standard, but I think I'm pretty level-headed now. And I taught myself virtually how to read, write and everything.
How was it leaving Westmead? How were you feeling?
Well, that's another interesting question, actually. I left after the school holidays in 54, that would have been early 55 in January. The brothers, or somebody, got me an apprenticeship pastry cook job with Carl's Restaurants, who had all the high class tea cafeterias in Sydney. They were very prominent. Therese Carl was a spinster, but she was a lovely lady, good Catholic lady. And we worked in a factory out at Waterloo, McAvoy Street, Waterloo, where we did all our catering. Everything by hand then, in those days. Then we eventually got machinery, but we had to mould everything. I didn't do that because I was only learning. I was sort of the labourer. Like they want a bucket of flour, you go and get a bucket of flour, milk and everything. We had about five or six bakers here. They were very good too. I eventually got to learn how to do things here. But the washing up was the problem. They had this joint tub. They used to call it a tub. And all, tin machines and all that. You'd have to make sure they're spotlessly clean before you left at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Have them all ready for the bakers who come in about 2:30 every day. And I bought a bike and used to ride from there to Coogee and back until some bugger stole it. You know, to get the old tram, the old 20-3 tram or 20-4 tram from Coogee to Waterloo, you know. Yeah, it was
probably would have been the first time they would have had mass production of that sort of thing, you know, like food, like mass producing baking and...
Oh, yes. Well, you've got to remember the cakes they cooked there. We didn't make any meat pies. They didn't eat those things in those days. They had specialist cakes and very, very nice, you know. The people, all the trendies used to go there before work, and that was a huge setup financially for Mrs. Carl. She put a lot of money into that. And she came over to the factory every day in a chauffeur-driven Bentley and checked everything. I can remember Mr. Godfrey was his name. He had a secretary. But as far as a manager, he couldn't manage a pigsty, I don't think, this bloke. I used to have to load all the trays into special catering vans, I suppose you could call them. And that, but I enjoyed working there because I had nothing else to do, and that was a job. So in those days, you know.
So what happened? You're not a pastry cook today. So.
No, what happened was I had to go to Tech every Friday at Eastern Suburbs, which is now the big art school there, isn't it, I think?
Opposite Darlinghurst.
Darlinghurst, yeah. Opposite Darlinghurst Jail. Well, I can remember we used to go there on Friday. I had to be there at 8 o'clock. And then you go and do your subjects or learn things from the, what they called it, bread baker section it was, and we had about 40 in our class. And next door was the artist who used to do the nude paintings. So we'd have a little bit of peep in that while we...
Yeah, the nude, the life drawing.
Yeah, they'd sit out in the sun. I remember that very vaguely. And I said to
them... Clearly, not vaguely. You remember that clearly.
Clearly, yeah. And I was amazed how they could sit there for hours and not move a muscle. But I can't remember much about that. But I didn't have anyone else to talk to, so I thought, what in the bloody hell are they doing there, you know? I was only a kid. Yeah. But I graduated with that. I came first in my class in ordinary productivity in relation to preparing food in mass, what's called, say they wanted hot cross buns or sponge cakes and that. I could do it quicker because they used to give you these little tests to do before you know, when they were examining you. And I think I got 12 sponges done in an hour and decorated them as they required, you know. And I've got a certificate somewhere here, but I wouldn't know where it was now. And I enjoyed that, yeah. Started National Service in 57. National Service, yes. And Randwick CYO dances were held on the hall upstairs from the Randwick Marshall College every Sunday. It was a very prominent dance. It was always packed. And we used to get one weekend off in four, and you had to wear your army gear because you had to be back out at Ingleburn at 12 o'clock on the dot. Otherwise, you'd do 3 days in the slammer. And a friend of mine, Mick Minogue, and I used to go there. And Mick was a reasonably good dancer because he was trained. And I just sat around, you know. And I met this woman who is now my wife. There was no feelings or anything like that because I was as scared as anyone else getting up on the dance floor, you know.
So how were you as a dancer?
I got a little bit better. But I didn't take it seriously enough. That was the trouble. Because in my mind, there was about 10 of us there in the army, from the army camp. You had to be back at that bloody thing. We used to get a cab at 20 to 12, organised cab, five of us, straight in there, and they'd fly out to Holsworthy camp. Otherwise, you weren't there by 12 o'clock, you'd be in trouble. Then I drifted away. Well, I didn't see my wife Bernadette probably for 12 months sometimes, or 6 months, you know, because you're out doing an army training and everything like that. And then I got involved with the surfing fraternity down at Coogee, where the Coogee Olympic pool there. I used to go there every day after. I'd always be home by 2 o'clock, and I'd go down there and swim for 2 or 3 hours and run up a hill and go home again. And I got quite good at it, you know. Then I came back, I met Bernadette. She must have come back to the dance one day, and she asked me to take her home. And in those days, there was a tram to Kingsford Junction, and you walk home from there or get a bus, but you wait hours for a bus. The trip was about probably 2 miles, I'd say, we'd walk home. And I don't think I ever kissed her then, I can't remember. And to make sure she got home safe, then I'd fly back home to where I lived, Coogee. And that's about all it was. Then eventually we became lovers, and it went from there.
What did you think of her family?
Well, it was a bit of a shock, and I can tell you that.
What was her father like on first meeting? What did you think of him?
Well, he was a very strict disciplinarian. You know, he was upper Royal Air Force, you know, retired. He was a demanding bugger. And I can remember the meal tables when I used to visit there. They'd give me a meal, but they had a huge, big table there. So there's Mum, the 11 children, and Dad here. And Dad had to be fed first. And if anyone was late, he'd give them a belt across the ear, because they all had to be there, say the grace and all that jazz. And he was very demanding, because he was in an insurance game then. He had to leave work about 6 in the morning every day too. He walked all over the place to sell insurance and that. Don't know very much about him after that. Yeah.
So what year were you married?
Married in 59 on the 27th of June at St. Joseph's Church at Rosebery.
Something about you posted the application to Green Valley that day.
Yeah, that day after, yeah, yeah.
So tell me how you were thinking about that before. Tell me what happened.
No, we were thinking about the Housing Commission. They advertised it very big in those days. And Bernadette would have had to write the letter, of course. And
so when you say they advertised it very, what do you remember about the advertising?
I don't remember that. I don't think I even...
So Mum was involved?
Mum did that,
But
yeah.
You said it was advertised very big. Why?
Well, they were looking for people to go out there. They built the big place. Huge, huge thing it was.
So it would have been in the newspapers?
Newspapers and things like that, yeah. And eventually in 64, we got an application to, you want a house, go out and see it. 59 Guernsey Street, Busby. And,
it was 51. No,
51, yes, yeah, sorry. My apologies.
That's all right. So it was 51 Guernsey Street. So did you both go and look at the house together?
No, we didn't have to look at the house. They gave it to you.
Oh, you didn't?
There was no inspections. Oh, no, you just go. You take the house or whatever.
Oh, right, but yeah. That wasn't the case for others.
No.
Others went and looked at houses and did certain.
No, they didn't. No. Not as far as I recall.
Mm.
They said, oh, you've got a house at such and such an address. Go out and find out where you're going to live.
So what did you do when you got that letter?
Oh, I can't recall that. No, I would never have.
When did you go to that? So what happened? Because it was quite a distance from...
Yes, it was, yeah.
Because you were living at Rosebery.
Living at Rosebery, yeah. But you got to remember, we had no furniture there. Anything like that. We only virtually took our clothes and probably one or two items. But when we went out there, all excited, I suppose. I can't really remember how I felt.
How did you get out there?
That's another good question. I don't know that either.
What are your first memories of Green Valley then? What do you remember?
Well, it would have been the police force, I think. Can't remember. Yeah, I would have been a policeman then, yeah. I was stationed at Liverpool then, No, I wasn't. I was stationed at Redfern.
So you would have had to have travelled to work.
Yeah. And right. Then they went. I went to the Radio Communications Centre in Phillip Street. That was the old one. Then after the travelling, Bernadette said, she said to one of the doctor, Tyndale, who was our family doctor, you know, he's coming home all hours of day and night for no fault of his own, and, you know, you were young kids and well behaved too, I might add. Then he got me transferred to Liverpool, which was only two bus rides home, you know.
So tell me about when you joined the police force and what that communication centre was. Was it like a switchboard?
Yeah, it was a switchboard, plugged in switchboard. And you had to learn all that. Very, very responsible job as far as I'm concerned. I finished up a supervisor there. Now it's all modern now, but it's not there anymore anyway. So,
what sort of, do you remember, anything stand out in your memories from that?
Well, we'd get a lot of calls, like there'd be a lot, you know, be a lot of hoax calls and that. But so you couldn't write down anything because you plug it in and you got, you know, these things on. And half the time you couldn't hear the person on the other end talking because they're probably ringing up from a traffic road or something like that. And if it was an urgent thing, you'd give it to the supervisor who had a table sort of thing like that where, boss, you know, take this one. And, it was mainly, you wouldn't have, in relation to Sydney, be all your problems around, you know, Darlinghurst and all those, Redfern and that.
Did they have that set up in other stations? Do you remember how many police stations there were around that time?
Oh, that's a good question. There were about eight major ones, what they call districts. There was Redfern, Newtown, Randwick. See, all these places, Darlinghurst. Well, an example is Darlinghurst. They do Darlinghurst right through to Paddington, Vaucluse, right out there, Roseback. Randwick, we'd go as far as Maroubra for crime things and all around there. And they were a big district, you know. They had no police. We had usually only one car or a truck in every station. So it was very difficult, you know.
Do you remember what type of cars you had in the initial years?
Well, you had a Ford truck. That was the wagon, a cage truck we used to call them. They were cage trucks then. And they were manuals. They weren't real hard to drive. Learn once you learn it, you know. And you'd be lucky to have one sedan car. But that used to be always taken by the boss or the detective. So you walked to half the jobs, you know.
How long were you at Redfern?
I was at Redfern when I was living at Rosebery. I recall about 2 years, I think. And we used to work night shifts. What they did then in those days, you work a fortnight, morning, afternoon and night. So you'd work 14 days straight, 6:30 till 2:30, 2 till 10:30, and from 10 to 6 a.m. in the morning. So at night time, they had a mascot, a police station, and a mascot, and since I was close to Mascot, they sent me there. And we used to get picked up, you know, by whoever's on that day. They picked me up outside Rose, you know, take me there. But they were busy times.
So what were your main duties then?
General duties, they called it. You'd go to, assaults, brawls, plenty of them around, stealings, motor car accidents, some very bad, domestics. And if you weren't supervised, because you had to be supervised, otherwise you can't. These days they work out on their own, a lot of them, but you can't do that now because it's too busy and, you know, everyone's got guns and knives and all that sort of jazz. It was very busy. Very demanding.
So how was it arriving at Liverpool? What describe what Liverpool... So let's focus on Liverpool and Green Valley now, if we can just sort of get you there.
Right. Once I left the communication branch, I got transferred to Liverpool. I was confirmed that by then. Yeah, that would have been 60... Around about 60... Must have been just as before we got the house at Green Valley. And Liverpool only, in those days, only had a four-bedroom home, five-row home.
And, police station?
Yeah, in George Street. And it was cut up in halves. So it was cut split in halves. There was a charge room, cells. The back of the place was all highway patrol cars, a whole three of them. We had two Holden sedans and a truck. And there was about 86 police there, including detectives and inspectors. And boy, we started when they first opened Green Valley. They didn't even have the names of the streets on the maps. And you'd have to go around, say Guernsey Street. Where in the bloody hell? And you'd spend all night going looking for Guernsey Street. By that time, the domestics are over and everyone's settled down again. And things like that. Well, that took years and years before the council got their finger out and did something about it.
So you're saying there were no street signs?
No street signs at all. Only the main one, like
Cartwright Avenue
and Maxwell Avenue, things like that. Other than that, you know.
And did you know them by their suburbs, like Busby, or was it just...
Oh, you learnt that as you went along, yeah.
So you'd, at that point you think it's Green Valley.
Yeah, they'd say, oh, go to such and such a place at Ashcroft. Where in the hell's Ashcroft? And you had a map, but no street names. And you waste a hell of a lot of time going up and down streets until the light was on. Oh, yeah, you know, they'd scream out for you. But then they eventually built a call box down at the intersection just opposite the church there and also the school.
Near the Green Valley Hotel.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah. And it was only a timber one. And they put four or five police in there. But they only had a sedan then. They eventually got a truck. And they were flat out all the time too. Mm.
So you were never stationed at Green Valley?
No. We used to do all their work because they'd close at 9 o'clock at night. So a night shift, you'd be doing the whole bloody area.
So what were some of the big problems in Green Valley that you remember? Like, how long were you at Liverpool?
Well, I did two stints at Liverpool. Green Valley, first to Liverpool, I was there for, what I can recall, about 6 years. At night time, 90% of your work, Green Valley were domestics, you know, some very bad, you know, some just, you know, a waste of time, but you had to go there every house, you know. So we had a system. We worked out a system, a night shift. The poor bloke, the husband, irrespective of who's at fault or not, shot him in the back of the truck at 11 o'clock and put him in the cells, charge him with drunk or something, you know, keep him up to, out of the house and take him home at 5 o'clock so he could go to work. And that was the secret around there. The bosses knew, and the bosses, that was the best system to do. And it worked well, yeah. We used to drive the blokes home, and they say, geez, thanks, mate, you know. He'd have a sleep, give him a sandwich or something before he left, you know. And that was a good system. But Green Valley, as you know, was a very, very busy place. It was all growing up and, you know. Then they built the pub, the hotel, Green Valley Hotel, owned by the Ryan family. Neville and Yvonne Bates became the first resident managers there. And it was a hub, very, very busy place, as you could expect, you know. The only pub between Liverpool and Green Valley was the Green Valley Hotel. And she's a wild old place. And the Green Valley police were flat out all the time, you know. They got to know all the hoodlums and everything. And they
Do you recall any of the hoodlums' names?
Yeah, the Kennedy's families. They were the notorious.
They were the stars.
They were the stars of the area, including Mum. Mum was
Trixie.
The worst. Trixie. She was number one down at the valley, and the family weren't much better.
Now, what happened with her husband? Did he go missing on a murder charge or something?
I don't know too much about that, but he was wanted for questioning in relation to a murder, and I don't know the outcome of that one.
I think he went missing.
Yes, I think he's still missing.
Mm. So what was sort of some of the main problems? Alcohol?
Alcohol was one. Domestic violence was
induced by alcohol.
Yeah. A lot of thieving. House thefts were enormous. Because, you know, people, no one locked their houses up in those days. You know, you could go up and down each street and, you know, you could walk in the backyard and take what you like and no one would, you know.
Well, no one had anything.
No, we didn't have much anyway.
Desperate times.
Oh, yes, that's right.
So what, how was it being a police officer, like, at that time?
It was very demanding. But I'm this type of bloke that I had a system in my own mind how to handle everything. I never told any constables to get aggro. Just play it cool and usually get good results when that happens. And I didn't take much work home with me anyway because I saw a lot of things that, you know, kids today wouldn't know how to even start it, you know. But I was well taught by supervisors. I was very lucky that way.
Yeah, that's good, isn't it, when you've got good mentors?
Yeah, yeah.
Who were some of those people
that
you respected?
The best bloke would be my traffic sergeant, Jack Beswick. He was a no-nonsense man. He told chief inspectors what to do if they had to, and he was only a sergeant. And no one crossed Jack. And as you know, the traffic around Liverpool at the time was chaotic because there was only one main road, the highway, one lane either way. Green Valley, Elizabeth Drive, you know, it was just crazy. Then they started putting signs up and then traffic lights and everything, and that made it worse anyway, as far as I'm concerned.
So you used to direct a lot of traffic?
I did a lot of traffic work. When I was at Liverpool, we'd do morning shifts. You'd get on the bridge, Liverpool Bridge, at 6 o'clock, and you'd have traffic flat out till 9:30. And anyone says it's easy to do a traffic point, just get up there with your white gloves on and do it, yeah. But I got quite efficient with it anyway, so it was good.
I noticed they don't wear white gloves anymore.
Ah, they just do this now, you know. They wouldn't have a clue.
Well, it's different times, isn't it? Everything's set up now. It's only when a light goes out or something. You're not actually controlling the traffic like you would have had.
Well, the whole thing with certain situations, well, the highways are the example. You know, the serious accidents, they call. And I've been to more serious accidents than these blokes have ever seen. But what you do, under no circumstances do you leave the cars there. And what they do now, because they've got the scientific, they've got the traffic experts. These blokes wouldn't know how to draw a cat, you know. And then they take photographs. Then they bring out an inspector. The inspector probably doing crosswords back in the station for all we know. Well, Jack Beswick and our boys at Liverpool, and that was a pretty busy traffic bump, get everything off the roads. Even if you had to put them in the driveway of a private house. They're off the road so the traffic can flow, see? And no one ever complained.
So you would have had a notebook and made good
notes? Oh, notebooks. I filled 27 notebooks in Liverpool in 6 years from accidents, just accidents alone. Because when you go to a fatal accident, it's different than just doing an ordinary accident, bumper to bumper thing. Well, the big one at Liverpool, I don't know if you recall it, they had the post office in the corner of George and the highway on the, would be the southwest building. And up on the roof of that, they'd have the statistic of traffic and the car, or the fatal accident car, shown to the people. Now to stay up there for a fortnight. And we had one Holden premier one Saturday night where they were drinking at the Railway Hotel, six young blokes. Anyway, they decided to go to a dance out Ingleburn way somewhere, and they're coming over the old bridge at Holsworthy to get out there. And they must have put the foot down, and it was only a timber bridge. It crashed into one of the poles, and six of them were killed outright. So you can imagine the work involved in that. I went out there with a Sergeant Martin, and we were there till 5 o'clock the following afternoon. You know, work, work, work.
Because the population would have been increasing, but the roads weren't improving.
Oh, the roads were shirking. They're still not the same anyway. And the population, as you say, is everyone's moving into the new suburbs. I think Ashcroft was the first one, then Sadlier, then what was the house?
Busby.
Then they had Miller. Then Heckenberg up the top.
And
then they had Miller.
Then Cartwright.
And Cartwright, yeah. Miller and Cartwright. Heckenberg, yeah. They were all enclosed, entwined, but they had... You know,
yeah.
I thought that the situation with, we were probably the biggest family as far as children concerned in the street, weren't we? Yeah, I think we were. Yeah, no one had seven children in the house like we did. It was only a sort of a box with three bedrooms, but we got there and eventually put a few additions on.
So you worked a second job.
Yeah, well, I started working a second job because in those days, we only my first pay was £3.46 a week when I was a probationary at Randwick. I remember that real well. But we're living at Bernadette's mother's place then. Then after we left that, we got an eventual pay rise. I don't know what it was then. And... I used to pay £2 to Mrs. Hodges every fortnight, you know, for upkeep, board and that. And she'd do all me washing, feed me and everything. She was a lovely lady. And I'd cut all the lawns for her on Saturday and, you know, things like that. So I was very lucky.
So when you, well, of course, you were having children and you didn't, when did you get your first car?
Oh, God. That was the old...
Holden,
yeah. EK, I think I saw.
A sedan,
yeah. A bloke called Kevin Harbridge up the road, a friend of ours, he bought it for us. Can't remember what I paid for it, but that was the first car.
There weren't a lot of cars in the valley.
No, no, not at that time, no. Nobody had any money, that's why. We're all struggling.
Do you remember the farm? Like, did you ever have, just out of interest, did you ever have to go out to Austral and all that farming area?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was all our area at night time.
And what would go on out there?
Well, you couldn't see anything because there was no lights, no traffic lights. They say, I go to Lot 44, Edmondson Road. Oh, yeah. Where's Edmondson Road? And you get out there and you spend an hour trying to find the street. And no traffic lights, no lights in the street. No numbers on the houses. And the only time you'd see it, if you go out there, at, say, 6 o'clock in the morning, you might find a number, you know. And, oh, God, it was a nightmare sometimes.
Because there wouldn't have been as many properties, would there? There would have been quite...
Oh, they were spread out, yeah. Yeah, we look at all the avenues there.
Yeah.
They all had properties on them. And eventually they became housing developments and people in cemeteries and all that sort of thing. But we used to do Liverpool in 64 was a district. So that means they had inspectors in charge. They had detectives. We had a highway patrol, general duties police and licensing police. And we'd go from Newbridge Road right to the intersection of Bankstown. That was part of the area. We'd go from there to Penrith, to Northern Road, Penrith. Then we'd go from the station to Ingleburn and Campbelltown. We used to do all that at night time. And you're always doing serious accidents all the time, you know, things like that.
It would have been a very different landscape back then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, you didn't worry about the landscape. You looked at trying to find where the domestics and everything were, you know, because...
But there wasn't as many houses, of course.
Oh, no, no. There were just vacant, you know,
farm lots of land.
Lots of land, yeah. But eventually, you know, it's like even the highway. It took them 10 years to build another lane there, you know, two lanes. And
what did you think of Liverpool Council at that time?
Oh, I didn't have much time. I was too busy to worry about the council, but they were a bit lazy, I think, then at the time.
Do you remember any of the local businessmen?
Yes, the guards who owned all the big furniture mob, I knew them pretty well. They were opposite the fire brigade station. They were there for years and years. Some of the solicitors there, the firms, they were all right.
Do you remember their names? It's not like today where they've got the Marsdens everywhere.
The Marsdens were there then.
They were.
Marsden had a shop in... No, he didn't have one in Liverpool. He had stacks of them out Campbelltown, wasn't he?
He's got one in Camden, Campbelltown and Liverpool now.
I can't remember the legal terms, but there were a few in different streets there.
So can we... just your second job. So you needed the money.
Oh, yeah, needed the money. So what I did the second job when I was working, when I first went to the radio section, this bloke come up to me. He said, look, if you want to earn some money, stick to this place for a while because you can work down the markets. I said, how do you do that? So he took me down and...
So what markets are we talking about?
The old Sydney markets, Haymarket they're called. It was a real Haymarket then. Boy, it was a good place to work. Anyway, we got introduced to a banana vendor called Broadbent's, R.J. Broadbent's and Sons. They were one of the biggest there. And I introduced him to Fred, the owner. He said, you can come down here, and he said, we'll teach you all about it. Anyway, I used to get the Mondays off and the Fridays off. You wouldn't have remembered that, of course. That's nothing to do with you. And we had to be there at 3 o'clock. And you knock off when the trucks from Queensland are coming. You have to load all the bananas up and load all the trucks up and all the orders and everything. It was interesting. I did that for many years. Yeah.
So how did the market operate? Do you remember? How did it look?
Well, it was a big produce. It was extremely... very, very very, very
organized.
Oh, yeah.
So the bananas, were they being one area?
Oh, no. The bananas were all different owners. It's like the produce, the pumpkins, apples, you know, they all had their own little sections. And there was a banana mob on the corner there that had one. Broadbent had the big one in the main. And they'd have a little one over here. So all the people, the fruiterers who come to buy their vegetables and that, they would have their own little parking areas. And they all, if they were our clients, that most of the trucks or the utilities would be somewhere near our factory.
Did you have wheelbarrows?
Well, you better believe it, wheelbarrows, yeah.
Because now it's different, of course. They have, you know...
forklift now.
All sorts of things. But you would all would have been manual.
Yeah, all manual. And they had... crates, wooden crates of bananas, 112 kilos, 112 pounds. You had to stack them on storerooms, storage rooms to, you know, they were green at the time, they had to, you know, gas them and that. And that torture, you think you pick up a thing like that. But in the end, I had no problems, you know, stack that high, you get up and do it. It didn't worry me. Then you'd be pulling... the old trolley along with your order, like you might have to put, say, 40 cases on such and such a truck, but you'd have to go back about four times to do it because, you know, then you've got to dodge all the other trucks and business going around. But it was a very good experience. Plus, it kept me fit too. And it saved a few vegetable prices at home. We used to bring a lot of stuff home.
Because you used to bring home, for us, everything was in bulk.
Yeah.
Like your box of apples, I remember.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, they give you... some of the Italians were very generous because I knew a lot of the fruit owners at Liverpool. That's how I got to know them all. And the gentlemen, they give you 10 bob in those days was a lot of money, And I don't think Mum had to buy any vegetables for ages once I got settled in there. We used to give a lot away too. I remember going to Dubois and a few other places, with the extras we had. I enjoyed the work.
How long were you at the market?
I would have been about 5 or 6 years, I think.
So you would have been quite exhausted. You were working all the time.
Yeah. Well, the whole thing was this.
Suppose you were younger, but.
Yeah, but would have had the wagon then, I think. The brown wagon.
You would have had the EK station wagon.
Yeah, that was the one, yeah. Well, I had to leave home at 3 o'clock and basically get a parking spot down there somewhere, away from the hay market. We all found out where you could park. By that time, Broadbent, one of his sons would have had the factory doors open, and they'd have these rooms where the bananas are stacked different size. Bananas are graded into 4 different grades, and they'd say, "I'll go upstairs and send down." They've got one of those lifts that keep going, what do they call them? Conveyor belts. So you'd have to go and put, say, 40 cartons of near the bale belt, and someone down the bottom had to pick them up and grade them. And you're going flat out till about 5 o'clock till about 10, Then you'd have a cup of tea or a sandwich or something. Then you wait for the trucks to come in to deliver to fill the rooms back up again. Very interesting work, but very demanding, but it kept you fit. Yeah, I was pretty fit then. Yeah.
All right, so we're going to go to the Green Valley Hotel now.
Yeah, right.
So you play golf. What was your golf club called?
I joined the golf club called the Corner Golf Club.
And how did that work in the pub? There was all different little groups.
Yeah, they had, the pubs had their own little groups. The Corner Club, and they had the Gamblers, the SP Gamblers were there. Their own little cliques, little corners where everyone, I'd meet you at the pub and you'd have 4 or 5 mates there on a Saturday afternoon.
And who would you meet? Tell me their names.
Oh, well, we had our own little...
Who were they?
The fathers we used to drink with, Cole Purcell, Paul McLean, Jimmy Camden, Mick Cleary sometimes. It was actually very noisy, but everyone was minding their own business and talking to you. And the beer was cheap in those days too for a while. There was never much problems there while we were there, but at night time, of course, it changes the attitude, with some of them.
And the hoodlums, they get in.
Yeah, they want to fight and everything, and that sort of thing. There's always someone who wants to take somebody on. And that's when the Kennedys and the boys came into it, and that's why they had to build the call box in the corner there. They sent out a few senior constables there that could handle themselves, which they had to because, Sergeant Witten and a few others, they were good. They kept it under control for a while. But it got too busy, see? That's the trouble.
Because it was a huge drinking hotel in history. It's the third biggest drinking hotel in Australia.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
So that's a lot of people, a lot of grog.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting, actually. Yeah. I don't know the full thing of it, but even two of my boys worked there part-time for a while, and picking up glasses and that. They saw a few things that woke them up a little bit, David and Gregory. I think Paul might have too. He might have worked there for some time too.
Did you get them a job there or did they get their own job?
No, they got their own job through their mates, their fathers playing football and their sons.
Did you ever coach any of the sports or?
No, I wouldn't have had time for that, no.
Can you tell me your children's names?
Yes, my eldest boy is Gregory Joseph Sweeney. We had twins, Therese Bernadette and David Michael, yeah. Then we had Michelle Francis, Paul Adrian, Daniel John, and Anne-Marie Sweeney. Is it seven? I think it is, yeah. I don't think it was a shock because I had no upbringing in a family. I never had a cup of tea with any of them. I never slept in a bed there or anything. I never had a cuddle for my mum, certainly not for my father. And I stayed at my brother's place at Stockton for 3 days, and that's about all I ever had relationship with my parents.
So how was it being a father from your perspective?
I think it was scary.
Oh, yeah, wrong word. So yeah. A lot of fear.
Because
you didn't know what to do.
I didn't know. Well, I didn't have any guidance, see. But I tried my best.
Did you feel love for your children when you had
them? Oh, yeah, I think I did, yeah. But as you say, I couldn't stay in the house long because I was either going to Marcus or going to work. Mm. When I was working the central, I had to leave, as you know, 2 hours before to get the train. If you missed the train, you missed the work, you know, and all that.
Well, that's right. It was so hard, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it was difficult.
The transport. And can I just ask, there was a lot of drinking in the force.
Yeah, oh, yeah, there was.
In those days, it was part of the culture.
Oh, yes. Well, central was an ideal place. It was the busiest police station in the Southern Hemisphere. We had... they had every section of the police force there then. We had four floors, and we had the detectives upstairs, the Rogersons and all them. Then they had the big licensing. They did the warrants section there and the big exhibition rooms. And at night time, on shifts, I eventually wanted to go and learn inside the station, so they put me in there and had to learn that from the ground up. And we had an old Hallstrom refrigerator. And I opened it one day and I said to the sergeant, that's full of grog. He said, that's all right, son. He said, it'll be empty when we finish the shift.
So you were drinking on the job was encouraged?
Oh, yeah, well...
Or not? No one cared?
No one cared, really.
Because Australia was a big drinking place back then. Oh, yeah. It was insane. Really, like, wasn't it?
If you didn't go to a bloke's house and not have a carton of beer or something, there's something awfully wrong with you. Yeah, as you know, you know.
It was just part of the culture.
And we couldn't afford a carton, of course. You know, we didn't have it, but...
But you liked drinking it?
Oh, yeah, it was good, yeah. Well, I think it brought... Camaraderie, right through it. Yeah, in those days, if you overdid it, which is you couldn't do it very much in Central because you had to get a train home, so you had to be on your toes there because you get the wrong train. I remember one night I finished up at the sliding yards of Blue Mountains. Had to get home, and I rang the hospital. I was in uniform, I think, gun and everything on. Hey, mate, he says, I think you're on the wrong station. Is this Liverpool? And he said, no. So I had to make a phone call, and they took me, highway car picked me up and dropped me up Parramatta, then Parramatta to back to Liverpool, to where I lived. But that only happened once in my lifetime, I think.
I'm just jumping to something that I want you to talk about. There was a football game held in Green Valley, and you were on that football team.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Now, let's talk about how that came up and what was it about?
Well, I think it originated from the hotel because we had the Miller Mob used to drink, Ashcroft Mob, Heckenberg Mob and all that, and the Busby Mobs. So we decided to have an over 35 football team. Competition. The Millers, the Miller Gorillas, Busby Bashers, Heckenberg Hawks, Ashcroft, I think they were the Angels. It was six teams and we played on Sundays. Sundays about dinner time at various ovals around the place. And we were the Busby Bashers and we never got beaten. But
is that true?
Oh, yeah, we were undefeated. We won the comp.
Who was in your team?
We had Jimmy Williams, who used to live up the street. Harbridge, Kevin Harbridge, he the greatest front rower I've ever seen. He lasted 12 seconds, got knocked out, and he's retired on the spot. Then we had Pete Smith, got knocked out, flying down the ring.
I thought you said you're undefeated.
Oh, no, we were. We never lost a game. And I was captain, and I played second row and lock, but we had the Biddlecams, Jimmy Biddlecam. He was a centre, and we had Williams was a ex-halfback, used to play for Cronulla, and they were good, you know, and Reynolds too. What was his name? The Reynolds usually back door, back house there. And we were fitter than most of the sides, but nobody had football gear. I kicked a goal from halfway barefoot. I couldn't put my police boot on the next day because my toes were smashed. And they put it in the local rag. These boots are made for walking. I kicked a goal halfway.
So where did you play?
We played at Whitlam Oval most of the games. Ashcroft had an oval. Miller had an oval. Cartwright had an oval. They all had ovals. But there weren't any grass on them. It was all shale and bricks and everything, you know. You come home with cuts all over you and half you.
So how long did that go on for, the that season? Was it just a one-off event?
Oh, no. It went for about a month because we had the grand final, at the big one at the corner there.
At MacGyver Oval, or what? Is that the one near where the Liverpool...
McGurr Park. So they had two 18-gallon kegs donated, one on each end. As soon as you scored a try, the player had to stop for 5 minutes to have a schooner. So we played the Miller Gorillas in the final, the Busby Bashers, and we wiped them 34-something, you know. And
wiped them clean.
Wiped them clean. Smashed them and everything. And
they would have been dirty.
Oh, they won the fight and everything, so we accommodated that. Anyway, I'm not exaggerating when I say that. I'd say there would have been 100 families watching it. And, of course, all the beer had to be drunk, so all the bloody fathers that were there watching the game, they all got a ball. I don't remember going home that afternoon, but she probably would.
Did you ever see any photos from that?
No. There was no photo. Yeah, it would have been good to have a couple of them. But I remember this bloke from, you know, he was a real smart, he thought he was good, one of the Miller Gorillas, second rower. And I used to see him in the pub and said, I'm going to get this bloke when we play on Sunday. He come down, he's going to score this try. And I chased him across the field and hit him around the legs and spun him around, you know. I don't feel too well, you know. You hurt me, you know. There's a man bigger than me, you know. Things like that. But it was all good fun. You'd go home and, you know, then I'd have to get in a police uniform, look like I'd been punched up by Muhammad Ali, you know. It was good fun. But
what about the balls and things you'd go to? Do you?
No, I don't remember much. I didn't go to many of them, I don't think.
Cabarets.
The cabarets are down at the hall, which I used to clean, ready for it.
Did you?
Well, that, how, what I, she'll probably tell you about that anyway. They used to have Housie there, and after Housie on Saturday night, if I was home, I'd go down there in the afternoon if I was on morning shift or a day off. I'd go and sweep it all up, clean it all up, kerosene the floor so it'd be clean, you know, with straw and that, sweep it all up and set it all up. And I used to do that when I was available, you know. Father Muldoon used to, you know, like me doing it because he knew it was done properly.
Now, we're going to wind up soon.
Good.
Is there anything else you want to... I kind of got more of a background rather than when you retired. Or what were some of the best things for you about the Valley?
Well, I think the camaraderie of the families. We all had tragedies. We all had upsets. None of us had any money. But the people were the nicest people you'd ever meet.
So you used to do pick-a-box for the church?
Yeah, pick-a-box on Saturday mornings, so down at the shopping centre. Monica and I and Jimmy Camden. And that we used to make £100, I think it was. Would have been £100 if on Saturday morning. That was a lot of money. But people used to come, you know, past us. And
they loved it, didn't
they? They loved it.
So what was the shopping centre like down there? Who do you remember? I remember I'd come down and scam a ticket.
Yeah.
You'd let me have a ticket.
Marino's were the Frutos. Patterson's owned the cake shop. I don't know who owned the newsagent. Then the Stewart had the shoe shop. There weren't too many more after that. Then at the time.
There was a chemist. Yeah.
And
so one, the ladies used to like you a bit, I remember.
Oh, yes, the Scotch lady in the chemist shop. I think you thought I was having an affair with her.
I didn't think you were having an affair, but she used to flirt with you.
And you got into it, didn't you?
I got upset because you were betraying our mother. But there was something about you used to like the women. You used to play around with the women a bit, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, I still do.
Not in a weird way.
Just my adult charm.
Oh, yes, you always had plenty of that.
Mm.
But, yeah, there was, they did like you, didn't they?
Yeah, they were good, yeah.
A lot of women did like you. Some of the women in, like, you know, Carmel Dwyer and Shirley, they all had a real, you know, they were a soft spot for you. Yeah. I know Ruth Hodgins does too.
Yeah. I don't know what Ruth's going to say, but she'll tell you.
Yeah.
Mm. But I think that, as you can see, we were blessed with a parish priest called Father Francis Muldoon. The responsibility of that man, when the Cardinal sends him out there, you've got to build a church and build a school. An amazing man. But the whole thing was this. We used to have the masses in the hall then, and all the screaming babies and everything. The average priest now wouldn't have a bar of it. It didn't worry Frank at all. You know, you just go along. And eventually we got working bees and went over the place was a tip across the road and we put in a lot of money and everything worked. They worked hard, everyone.
When you'd go to the sports days, your children would be winning the events. What did you think? What did you feel about that?
Oh, I was quite... I didn't get overexcited, I think, because I knew that our kids were the best at the school, which we were.
How did you know that?
Because all the parents used to say, you know, oh, bloody Sweeney's again, they won this. Well, you were a champion athlete. Greg and David were the top rugby boys.
And cricket.
And cricket, yeah, very good. Cricket, particularly indoor cricket too. I think that might have come from my fitness centre at the time, or they got my genes.
And Mum's family.
Yeah, Mum's family. Oh, yeah, they were good too, yeah.
John were very athletic.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Philip
so
too.
So we got it from Mum's family as well, I think.
They were outstanding because they were an upper level where you'd have in a football side, just use this as an equation, you'd have a centre, like one of the Burns kids. He'd get the ball and he wouldn't know what to do with it. But if Greg got the ball, he'd know where to go and he'd eventually score a try and things like that. I think they grasped their sport a lot quicker than most families did, sons and daughters. You agree with that, I think. Yeah, pretty proud of it. But the Sweeneys were the name of the athletic world then around the place.
One of the names.
One of the names, yeah. And little athletics, they were good, well organised, and that we used to work hard with that with Bert Alexander and a few others.
Graham Davies.
Yeah. And as you know well that they were well patronised by all the families too. Parents were there. Other than that.